Go loud.
Watch your waiting for, watch your back in it, just a little more, throw your whip in the snow, fill your body up tight, walk it hard and slow, when you finish that,
deep naga.
Episode 181 of Talking Bollocks, brought to you by Go Loud. It's me, Terry Flower.
It's me, COB.
And this week, me, DOD.
I love it. The crosses, right? You can tell this is not your first rodeo.
181.
181.
Wow.
Yeah, and the bonus episodes as well. So we're well over the 200 mark, Danny.
Fair play to you.
We're meant to be experts. You'll see now in a minute.
Experts. That's what I heard.
So, mate, you were telling us you just had to come in from like a listening event.
Yeah. So me and Glenn flew over because our album Satellites is finished now, and every album cycle we hire a place. We usually do it down Ringsend Road recording studio, and then we get about 20-30 of the worst reviewers and press people into a room and then sit there scouring like, come on, impress us. So yeah, it's just fun because we spend so much time in the studio, and then this is now when I know it's actually getting real.
Yeah,
like it's really real now. I have to, like, what was the inspiration behind the song, and I have to kind of, I guess, like, make it edible, you know what I mean, because some of these songs are written in a really hard or bad time, or in your deepest darkest moments, and then you're kind of like, right, lights are on, sell it, you know. And it's kind of, it's weird, but you kind of get through, you kind of trip up a little bit and then start to kind of find your feet and start falling through it.
Yeah, it's hard to just turn on and off though, isn't it? As you said, like, you're written in a dark time and emotions, you can't just keep turning them emotions on and off though.
Yeah, I find that quite hard. I mean, even, let's say, after the year that we've had, everybody knows, I'm just grieving openly, you know what I mean? Because we're kind of going through this grieving process and trying to get ourselves back on our own feet again. And it's mad. Some days I feel like, all right, I've got it. And then other days, just someone asks you one question and just knocks you for six, you know?
Yeah. Danny, we start every episode with zingers. I'm not sure if you've ever listened to
an
episode.
Yeah, of course I have,
Or like, grew up out of that.
Yeah, I love it.
A little humble brag there, isn't it?
No, I've seen you on the late as well. It's great.
Yeah, we're robbing a living, Danny,
Because we were just talking about that before you come in, so... I'll get into it in a minute.
Which thing are you going to give me?
Yeah.
Because, I piss in the shower.
Well, I said
and a fountain as well. Yeah.
I said to Terrence, we haven't asked that in ages. He goes, the last time you asked that to someone was Patrick Kilty on the Late Late Show. And he was like, Jesus, did it hit you that hard that you can pinpoint and exactly remember where it happened?
Yeah.
So, well, there you go. You caught that one there.
The way you say it, that was great. You piss in the shower or you're a liar.
Well, at least you admit to it, Danny. It's nice to know that you're as straight as an arrowhead.
100%.
Yeah. My thing of the year was Stone Roses or Oasis?
Oasis.
You answered that quick.
Yeah.
So did you.
Although I had me and Ian Brown went along with his kids to go see Man United play. We went to City's ground because my manager has inns over there. So I went with Ian Brown, and City scored. And I'm sitting there, and I was the only one in the whole place who was actually sat, because we were in the director's box. And I was just sat down like this, and it was me, Ian Brown, his kids. And I was sitting there, and somebody in a suit, it was Man City guy, comes over in a suit, and he just notices, obviously I'm the only one who's not gone, so he's obviously United. So he came over and he grabs me by the shirt and just reefs me up. I'm talking, like, by my neck, I'm up about this. I'm trying to punch him like this. And Ian Brown came over and just, like, started banging your man's arms. Get me down. So I wanted to go looking for him at half time, because he was the director. He was one of the directors. He was like, come here, up out of your seat. You're a United fan. And I had a bit of history with Ian Brown. I should have said Stone Roses. Yeah. They did. They sent me a load of United gear, because they have all this.
Yeah, the collab. It's Whopper, isn't it?
Stop, dude. So I had, they sent me down, this is a gas story. They sent me down probably about 700 quid's worth of stuff in a box, and I put it in the studio, and I was like, "Gran, have that now, because all my family are United fans." I said, "I'll divvy that out now for them." I came back in the studio maybe 2 days later, and I put the box right where the bin is, and the cleaning lady had come in. Yeah, what'd she tell me? Oh, I thought it was trash. A whole box full of United gear. I mean, it's open; you can see that it is. Anyway, so big hullabaloo going on. I then was like, listen, I need to get the money back for it. How much was that worth? She said about 700 quid. So the cleaning company gave me 700 quid back. And then what arrived the next day? Another box full of all the gear.
Like, so handy one.
Double me money, bro. Double it. It's great.
Handy one.
Yeah. I'll knock the hustle.
Yeah.
I have another one for you.
Oh.
Arena or festival?
Do you know what? Depending on when you're asking me, but I like festivals. Like when it's your own show, you're guaranteed everyone's going to clap at everything. Do you know what I mean? If it's your own wedding, everyone's like, oh, it's great. But I find the energy at festivals is, they're not necessarily there to see you. I don't know. I always just imagine me being in the crowd because that's how I kind of grew up, was going to festivals, and I live right beside where Marley Park is, so I'd just be in there in the audience in the crowd. But I love turning a crowd. I quite like to turn people who were maybe not necessarily there to see you, but, you know, come up at the end and like, you were all right, like, yeah, it's all right, sound, like, you know, you've won someone over when they're doing that to you, you know.
That's the proper order to shot the show, didn't it? You were all right.
Yeah, you're all right. You weren't bad, you know what I mean? Not giving you too much, you know?
Yeah.
What you waiting for? Put your back in it. Just a little more.
This podcast is supported by FlyFit. With 20 locations nationwide, there's always a FlyFit gym nearby to help you crush your fitness goals. Starting from just €35 per month, you'll get access to state-of-the-art equipment, unlimited classes and facilities that make every workout first class.
Smash your fitness goals guided by expert trainers and surrounded by a supportive community. That's a FlyFit promise.
Join the FlyFit family today and start your journey to a fitter, healthier you.
Visit flyfit.ie to find your nearest location and sign up. Right, Danny, with this podcast, we like to take it back to the start. So tell us where you're from. What was life like growing up?
I'm from originally from Ballantyre. I came from six children. We're all pretty much in or around the music industry. My dad was a prominent musician around Ireland. He wrote a song called Baby, I'm Your Man for a guy called Dickie Rock. Do you remember? Spitting me, Dickie.
I wouldn't remember him, but me man.
Your man, no, I was, yeah, 100%. Oh, back in the show band era, he was in the band. And he was kind of, he was writing and producing and stuff. And he ended up managing a few different places. The old Sheeling Ballroom, McGonagall's, where else? The Dublin Sports Hotel, for this guy called Bill Fuller, who was a bit of a head around town. And he managed golf clubs as well, did like a whole lot of kind of stuff that we're still trying to figure out what he was doing, who was a bit shady, you know what I mean? It's like, you're in music, then you're in golf clubs and sports and entertainment, but you knew some mafia people, all right, okay. But yeah, he was a very prominent musician, played with Tom Jones and Roy Orbison and people like that when they rolled through. And then my brother's, Dara, was in a band called The Big Geraniums. They had huge success. I think their album was number 3. The Coltranes, my brother Ian, was in a band. They had a number 1 album as well. They were all, my ma's the only woman in Ireland to have all of her sons on the Late Late Show, all in 3 separate bands in different times. My sister sings. One of my sisters is completely tone deaf, but she loves a shout. She doesn't sing, she shouts. People would be saying, who's that talking in the back there? It's gas. And then my other sister Mandy is a hairdresser. But I grew up in Ballantyre back before it was nice, if you know what I mean. It was like the sticks up there, it's just up in the mountains. So I had like, we kind of got the best of Dublin because you could just head into Dublin on the 48A. And then when you got back, then I had the mountains behind us. And there was still kind of, urban sprawl. So they were still building all the houses there. So it had all just nothing but construction. So for kids, it was just a playground. I know you shouldn't be playing in anywhere near his construction sites.
Yeah.
But great crack growing up as a kid, you know what I mean?
Yeah. Obviously, music goes right through your family. How early then did you start singing and knowing?
Very young, I reckon, because when you're in our house, like my dad, he'd play in the local place, the Coach House or the Ballantyre House on a Sunday. And because he was doing the job, he's doing the golf course during the week. And then he had his own following anyway. So he just never gave up music. So he'd be playing in the Coach House maybe on a Friday night and a Sunday night. And then he'd finish there and then all of the people in the coach would come back to the gaff.
Yeah.
And then that's it. There's 50 people in the house. I'm being torn up out of bed, right? Yeah. Doing me little
down and drinks. Sing.
Yeah, go down and sing. And, you know, me and my sister would be walking around with plates doing it, you know, doing the whip around and all that. But so it would have been very, very early on. I see my dad playing and he was an amazing singer, but he could reduce people to tears with just playing Misha Era or, you know, playing any of the old tunes and stuff. And that to me was a big lesson because I used to live downstairs. There's a lot of people in the house. So it was a 3-bedroom. Well, 2-bedroom upstairs, 3-bedroom, my ma's room, then all the girls would be in one room and the lads were older than me. And then the only other spot that was kind of available for me was we had a music room downstairs and we had a mattress that was on the floor. So I used to sleep in the music room downstairs right next door to the kitchen. And the room was unbelievable. My ma, for 20 years, let us write and draw on the walls. So if you've ever been backstage at a gig somewhere and you just see like it's 20 years of people just being this band, that band, you're drawing dicks and fucking all sorts of shit on it. But it was that was the room I grew up in.
Yeah.
I had a piano in the corner, I had a guitar and bass, a few microphones and the mattress. And that's, if there was a party coming on at night time, that's it. I'm up. You know, it didn't matter if I had school the next morning.
Yeah, no choice.
No choice, really. So, like, the memories of it are really fond. I have of it because it was party time and I kind of learned me trade. But looking back now at it, I was only hearing it yourselves, it's like, it's tough going to school because I had to go to school the next morning.
Yeah.
When you've got all of that going on and stuff, and it's, you know, like you said, it catches up on you. But I didn't have any worse or better than anybody else growing up. Sometimes we had money, sometimes we didn't. Sometimes it was great, sometimes it wasn't. Yeah.
You mentioned there you had to go to school the next day. So what was school like? Or did you know, like, this is just a technicality, I'm going to be a musician?
Not back then, because I was in Holy Cross School, so it was primary school. I just remember being tired most of the time. Tired, and then first few, like an hour or so, I'd just be gone, you know. And then I got in a lot of trouble growing up. I don't know, I had issues with anger growing up. Did mental things, like people be getting your Lego and stuff and breaking it up, you know, tidy up for lunch, tidy up for lunch. I grabbed a pencil and I stabbed a kid in the back with a pencil because he broke up my Star Wars toys. It's ridiculous. And then I had to stand by the milk thing for a whole 2 weeks and whatever it was, like, just while everyone's doing their lessons. And it's a bit mad. Do you know what I mean? Kids, but you don't know what's going on, or you don't know how to take out your anger or what's going on around you and stuff, you know?
Yeah.
Bit mad. Sorry, that threw you there, didn't it?
I'll be off guard now. What was secondary school like then, if that was primary school? You didn't go around stabbing people with pens then, did you?
No. It was just up the level. No, I think by secondary school, I went to Benilda's secondary school. I wasn't great in school, to be honest. I was like, you know, they have very smart and then the intermediate and then woodwork classes and stuff. And then I was kind of mid, because we did music. If you're in the mid class, you could do music. So I was like, right, I'm quids in, I can do this.
Yeah.
I had great teachers, but I just wasn't ready to be taught. And then I failed music in school. And so I had an amazing teacher, and in fairness, me teacher, Mr. Morgan, I don't even know if he's alive, but if he is, shout out. He used to kind of, you see mad things, we'd turn off all the lights and then we'd listen to music. And he'd say, right, what can you hear there? Can you hear, name all the instruments you can hear? So we were listening to concertos and all this.
Yeah.
And he used to tell me, what instruments can you hear? So I just remember music then not being one kind of solid thing that came at me. I was able to separate it out and then go, oh, I can hear the music, I can hear the voices, I can hear the guitars, I can hear the bass. Is that a cello? So I was able to name all the instruments and then pick out the chords and all that kind of stuff. But when it came to the test, where was Beethoven born, or what was his parents doing, and the years and stuff, and I went through school, and it's mad because all of those things, I was like, I'm just stupid. I'm not going to remember any of this stuff. And when years and years and years and years with thinking all of these things, like, how did that information stay in about a melody? You whistle me one melody or an old ad from back in the day and I can, like that, I can pick it up. But dates and numbers and stuff, and I'm very bad at mathematics. But music is maths, you know, and it's exactly mathematics, you know.
Octaves,
but I can have this, you know, and the doubles of it and the octaves is, you know, it's double exactly what the first original note was and stuff. And I'm super interested in all that. But I only found out literally earlier on this year, I'm dyslexic.
You only found out this year?
44 years old and I found out that I'm dyslexic. And all of those mad things that went on as I was a kid, like, can't concentrate in school, things he's not getting, this, that, and the other. And I was like, what a mad thing to find out at this age, you know? And I was like, well, that explains... In retrospect, it explains so much to me. I was like, if only I had known, you know. And it's like, if you're dyslexic, what I would normally do is, like, let's say if I had to read something, I'm okay because I can read out loud and I can read, and that's not a problem for me. But sometimes I get my letters all mixed up, can't spell to save me life. And then I'll also put, like, the capital T's and C's and dots, and just my grammar's all over the place. And I mean, like, I'm not stupid. But I just cannot spell the same word over and over again my whole entire life. But it spills over into stuff like, you know, work for me. So I'll, like, it'll be something, maybe I have to learn something on the day. Well, I can't learn things as fast as somebody else. So I'll get, my anxiety will build up loads and loads, and then I'll end up throwing a tantrum, and then I won't want to go in and do what it is. And I never knew why. I was just like, I just get this feeling like I don't want to be in there or whatever. And it's my brain going, you know what's going to happen here? You're going to get embarrassed because you can't pick this up as fast as everybody else. And what you'll do is you're going to make a show of yourself. So don't even, like, blow up over something else and don't even go in there. And I was like, I couldn't believe it. Excuse me, when I was talking to my doctor about it. And, it's mad. It's mad to kind of go all these years without knowing that stuff.
Yeah, you know? It's mad the way that you think about, like, you failed music and then how successful you are in music and how you said now that you understood, you were able to break down and understand what actually music is based off the instruments and what the teacher was, like, trying to communicate to you. it shows that there is a problem with the system. Like, the system's just set up as a memory test, really, isn't it? Whereas you're somebody yeah. who actually does, it's proven, you understand music, you know how to yeah, play music, yeah. but on paper, you failed at music. You know what I mean?
Well, exactly. I failed at music. I then left. I got a decent, me junior cert results were decent, but I left school. I left school just after 4th year. And then I went to Rathmines Tech. And I went there for, I just needed a change, get out of the school, because it's just, you know, I was, you know, smoking and
yeah.
all sorts
and
whatever.
Bollocks, yeah.
Yeah, acting like bollocks. So I left to go to Rathmines, where there's no uniform. You're allowed to smoke.
Mm.
I was actually just more at my pace kind of thing. And it's funny, we're actually in relatively around where Diggs Lane is. Diggs Lane.
Yes, yeah. This is Diggs Lane.
So I used to teach here. I used to teach breakdancing here when I was that age. So I was about 15, 16 and I was teaching Mark, who was, God rest his soul. I met him through, he was a breakdance teacher. So I was like, went to him for lessons. We ended up getting a friendship together or whatever. But I was, while I was in school, I was doing the dancing thing and I'd been earning a bit of money. And then I went to Rathmines. And then in between the summers of 5th and 6th year, I was chatting with my year head, Miss Friel, at the time. And she said, she had brought me parents in for a teacher meeting. He's like, look, he's not doing F all at the back of the class, just sitting there writing songs. That's all he's doing, writing, you know. But here's the thing, it's like, they're really good. He needs to do something with it. He's like, it's probably not, school's not meant for him. But she gave us a number at this place called the Parnell School of Music. And you didn't need grades for it, but you did a practical.
Mm.
Yeah,
and you just go in and show them what you can do, as opposed to learning what you
yeah.
can do.
Yeah,
and that's where I shine. Do you know what I mean? So I was like, where for all intents purposes, you look at my music results in school, you go, well, he's a waster.
Yeah, yeah.
And then so I'd say I would be the most successful out of school, if not in the country. If you
yeah.
know what I mean.
Mm.
And then I went to Parnell School of Music, went there to learn just production, singing, songwriting, performance, everything I was doing. Diggs Lane was already a big hand in that as well, and then. I was about 4 months into that school, and then I got my first record deal when I was 16.
So yeah, young.
And then we got signed to Universal in America in the biggest pop deal in history. It was 15 million quid we got signed for. And then...
Is it just you and Mark in this now?
No, it was me, Mark, another guy, Terry Daly, and a guy called Paul Walker. And the four of us were in a group called My Town, and we got signed. We went over to America. Ended up moving over to the States. And then we worked over there. We had so much money thrown at that first album. We worked with, like, I don't know if you might know them, Blackstreet. Do you remember Blackstreet? Teddy
yeah.
Riley?
No yeah, Diggity. No Diggity.
Yeah. So we worked with him. They kind of gave us a sheet of who do you want to work with. And I was like, man, Boys the Men, Montel Jordan, this is how we do it. Like, everyone I was listening to at the time was going in there, you know. I wanted to be the fifth member of Boys to Men. Do you know what I mean? It's like, don't tell him he's not black. And put like a hit list down of loads of people, and we ended up getting to work with them. And that album, we had one song people knew from the album, and then it tanked. We did a Smash Hits Roadshow, you know, went around the UK, and then it was just like, fell off a cliff. And there I was, like, washed up 18-year-old. I just had me big chance in music, and it totally fell on its arse. And so I just kind of took the money that we'd earned. We earned a little bit of money. And when you say we got signed for that amount of money, but seven albums, and then it goes, you know, by the time you've earned all your money out of it, you owe them money. You know what I mean? So, but yeah, we took what little we had, me and Mark, and we'd been writing and producing. We took the money, and then we went to the States, and we started kind of off in Orlando. In Florida, we had a friend of a friend. It ended up being Mark's wife was working with Justin Timberlake's manager, Johnny Wright. And she said, well, look, me and Mark know how to write and produce. Would you just come over and do a few tracks for us and stuff? So we had absolutely nothing to lose. So I went over, took 100 quid in my pocket, went over there and basically never left. Went over and we started doing songs and just, you know, beg, borrow and steal and what we can do while we were over there. Made a
what
bit
was that
of
like? What
help.
Is that thought process when you're going over there? You have fuck all. Is that just kind of trying to blag his away?
Basically, yeah. We've been blagging our whole lives. You know, we've blagging our whole careers. You know what I mean? For real. So I always felt that, like, America was a place that if you had a dream and you had a promise, you could go over there. And if you've got the gift of the gab.
Oh, yeah. You'd walk rings around them over there.
You really do. You know, it's no disrespect. It's just Irish people have an unforeseen confidence that just you can convince anybody of anything if you put your mind to it. So we went over and I was like, cool, you know, I was only going to go for a few weeks, went for the 2-3 weeks. And then before I knew it, my visa was up, I came back. I was lucky enough, while I was in the band to get an O&V visa, which is a 3-year visa. So I was like, happy days. You know what I mean? I got 3 years now. I can be out here. So we did everything from like, we did a remix for Justin Timberlake to like ripping some kid off on the street being like, listen, do you want a beat? You know, how much have you got on you? Like, I've got 50 quid. Cool. Right. Whatever. I was doing anything I possibly could, but all to do with music.
Yeah.
To try and make it work while I was over there. But we, like I said, we did a little bit of production. Then we get paid. So if we did a track for Justin, we did Gone, a song that he wrote called Gone while he was in NSYNC. And we did a two-step remix because Craig David and Artful Dodger and all were kind of in at that point. And we were the only two Europeans in America doing that kind of style of music. So we did that. You get like $5,000 for that. It's a buyout. So sometimes you don't even get your name on it. I managed to get my name on it, but they gave $5,000. So I don't get any royalties or anything like that from it. Yeah. So they just buy it off you. And then that would do us for 2 months. You got rent paid for 2 months. Happy days. Mm. And then we can kind of go back to writing and stuff and then trying to get stuff. Just, it's the same as just making anything. You're just trying to write your way out of a bad situation, yeah.
Did you write any songs? So you said that you were bought out of that and you managed to get your name on it, but did you do any big songs that you haven't got your name on that people would know?
No, I was actually looking at this one the other day. It's a crap song and I'm glad that my name is not on it. But I wrote a song for the Rugrats movie. Yeah, and I got 500 quid for it. And Chrissy Hynde sang it with a duet with Bruce Willis. When I wrote it, it was called A Dog's Nose Knows It All. A Dog's Nose Knows It All, I think, I warned you. So I wrote it and I got bought out basically. So, but I was looking for that the other day because I was like, fucking, where's that song gone? But I'm trying to think of anything else. I got a call from this guy called Rodney Jerkins one time. He produced for like TLC and all.
Yeah.
And he says, come down to the studio. I heard you play guitar. I says, yeah. And I went down and I ended up playing just this track. It was just a track, whatever. He says, play guitar on it. So play guitar on it. And then it was about 3 months later, my mate who'd worked on the track and produced it sends me this track. And I was like, is that TLC? And he goes, yeah, it's TLC. I'm like, that's me playing guitar. He's like, yeah, it is. She's on the song. I'm like, what? So I ended up playing on the track called Turntable, which is the Lisa Left Eye Lopez is the girl who passed away from the band. Well, it was they wrote a song about her and it was that song that I ended up playing guitar on. And I was like, I've made it. Mm. That's it. You know what I mean? And I looked up the credits and it's Dunny O'Donoghue.
No. On
the I didn't misspell my second name in it. Like, oh, it's D-O-N-A-H-U-E or whatever. I was like, it can't. Me mate and I won't even believe me when I got home. You know, I'd be like, look at him going, you big tin roofer. You can't hear what I. But yeah, there's been a few times when. Yeah.
I've noticed a couple of times I've heard you in interviews and stuff like that saying, oh, we blagged that way. Is that like imposter syndrome that you have?
Now it is, yeah, because I don't feel like I deserve any of this or that it's worthy because we've been bullshitting people for such a long time. Because you bullshit and then you get the skills that appropriate your bullshit level and then now the skills are surpassed, but I still feel like I'm pulling the wool over the world's eyes in a weird way. And I don't know what it is. It's like an Irish thing.
I was just going to say, is it an Irish thing?
I don't know because I don't want to pinpoint it as being that. Because I know, like Ed Sheeran has imposter syndrome. When I was chatting with him, everybody who kind of gets a little bit, I don't mean above their station, but if you succeed, it's almost like you want to be apologising to people when you come back. I'm so sorry, I'm famous and I have money now. And it's you're almost apologising for the success that you've had.
It's like guilt. Yeah.
It is. It really is. It feels a bit guilty sometimes, but yeah.
But you can't still say that you're blagging it, Danny. You can't like,
no.
If you're 2 or 3 years in it and you had success, I'd be like, oh, maybe he is, but you can't now. Come on.
Yeah. I've kind of grown a bit more into it now. And what I love doing is I love letting people see behind the curtain. Mm, do you know what I mean? Because there is a way you can be to be famous and certain people think that you have to be this way or that way. And I love just like knocking it down, Jenga style, bang, just, you know, letting people know that it's, you know, fame is like a magnifying glass.
Yeah.
If you're an asshole before, you're an even bigger asshole after that.
Mm.
But yeah, it still comes every now and again. You get past imposter syndrome and then you think, when is it all going to end? When is my natural, because there's an up, there's got to be a natural, you know, a natural decline, I think. I still haven't found it yet.
Yeah, that's grand. That's good.
Yeah.
Enjoy it. You're still on the way. So, you're going around America. You're pulling the wool over the American's eyes for a while.
Yeah.
How does the script form and what's that like then?
Well, just before the script. So, we were living in LA just before that. And then, Orlando before that. And we got down to our last few books and we were, you know, it was either you get rent or food or what's going on, electricity or food or whatever. And I remember, because Mark's from James Street, And he's kind of a little bit more daredevil in him than me, right? And I remember the electricity went gone in the house. We'd no money. And we just bought a load of food for the fridge. And all the food was basically going to perish. I was like, what the fuck are we going to do? And he says, listen, they all have all those ice outside the front of the garages. Let's just go and fucking steal some ice. I says, yeah, right, cool. So two of us walked up, grab a load of ice and fucking legging it into the gaff, poured all the ice into the bath, got all the freezer stuff out there, put it all in the thing. We got another week out of food. And in the meantime, we decided, I had known a friend who lived in LA, and I was like, look, we've kind of dried up a lot of the work that was in Orlando, maybe overstayed our welcome a little bit too much. But LA seemed like another place where if you get your foot in the door there, you can, like I said, we're still trying to make ends meet from one month to another. But when you get to LA, it's like a bigger Orlando. There's loads more opportunity. Mm. And then I can use those things that I did in Orlando as a calling card with the industry that's in LA. So I went up there, and then I started off in this place. A friend of mine owned a studio, which was it's called Cloud 19. And they used to author DVDs. So they used to basically take all of the old titles from Miramax, and they take all the videos, and then they do the scene selection on them. You have to sit there, watch the movie, cut it up into the 16 different sections. Then you have another fellow who's working on an Avid computer who sorts out all the scenes on it. I know I'm even boring myself even talking about it, so just let me know.
I'm trying to follow it, no?
Yeah, well, so he let me in on his blag, and so he was just doing all these things. So you'd watch the movie. I got paid to basically sit at nighttime, watch all these movies, King Solomon's Mines, and then just find a point where it's like, the king returns, and then just write that down. But then I'd have to listen to the soundtrack and then recreate the soundtrack and then put that little annoying 30-second piece of music. You know when you're hammered and you're like, you're lying there and you have to leave in a DVD on, and the same fucking piece of music goes again and again. It's only after finishing it starts again. That was me on over 200 titles I did. And then I did that for a little while for time in the studio and then just started writing. And then Mark moved up. He drove in a U-Haul all the way across from Orlando to LA, yeah. Him and his missus in the back of the U-Haul.
A few days there.
Yeah, it was a week and a half actually.
What?
Took them, yeah. Mm. Yeah, in a U-Haul. So like a rented car the whole way across. And then, yeah, and then we got to LA, and then we just started. I'd been working on my own solo project at the time because I was writing stuff for people like Aaron Carter and like just pop dudes. You know, we had, there was a boy band called Natural that recorded one of our songs and stuff. And I just ended up thinking, I just feel like, no disrespect to their talent, but just like, these are my songs and I feel like I could do a better job.
You could justify them.
Yeah, I could do it. Yeah, I don't mean a better job. I just mean they were meant for my voice, if you know what I mean. So I started writing for what I thought was going to be me project. And me and Mark had been writing for years. So he'd just involved him in the project. And then he met Glenn in Dublin. And I hadn't met Glenn before, a drummer. And it's funny because my dad was a musician. Glenn's dad was a musician. And they played together years ago.
That's fucking mad.
Because we never met. I never met Glenn until I met him in LA. But when I live in Ballantyre, he lives in Stillorgan. So we live
on each other's stones throw.
I mean, I went to Benilds, he went to Oatlands. So like schools are nearly half a mile close to each other. And I never met him. And Mark brings him over because he met him over here. And he's like, telling him, he's like, fucking amazing drummer. Like, when you hear this fella, he's brilliant. And he'd never heard him.
Again, so he's flagging you.
Fucking waffling, waffling. So we were in a studio with Nine Inch Nails. And Nine Inch Nails owned the studio and the drummer was there. And pressure was on. Do you know what I mean? I'm telling the Nine Inch Nails fella, oh, you want to see this drummer? He's bleeding amazing. Yeah. Mark's telling me, oh, fucking hell, nobody's heard the guy, you know? And because Glenn was so confident in what he could do. But he went in and blew everybody away. Like, your man's jaw was on the ground, because it's funny because he's not just a drummer, he's a world class drummer. He's like Stuart Copeland from the Police style, really savant stuff. Like, he plays piano better than me, he can fucking sing more in tune than me, can play drums. Thank God he can play drums. I can hide him
in the back.
You know what I mean? But now he's a fantastic musician. And we met then. We went down to karaoke night and had a falsetto off. He does a badass Bee Gees impression. And we went out and got trashed. And had that, and then just got on really well. And then literally a week later, I think, was a friend of ours, Steve Kipner, called us up, and he'd started a label called Phonogenic. And Phonogenic had signed Natasha Bedingfield, and they were flying with her now. She had a number one album. So the label were throwing money at them to find more people. And I'd worked with Steve. This is where I'm bringing it back around. The very first band that I was in that was The Failure, I'd met this guy, Steve, and we'd worked together. when I was in my town with Mark. And he was asked, well, look, if you could, you know, work with guys again, who would you do? And he says, let me just see what those guys are up to now. So he called me and Mark, and he's like, out of the blue, we just finished the first EP, which had We Cry, Before the Worst. We had these two other songs. We didn't even write Man Who Can't Be Moved or Break Even or none of those. Mm. So we just had those first two songs. And then we sent it to Steve as my project. That was just me. And he called back and he was like, he's Australian. He's like, mate, amazing. What's the band? What's the band called? And we're like, fucking things, we're a band. Like, seriously, you're like, oh, yeah, I know. Yeah, we're a band. You like, showcase. Fucking joke. Yeah. We can get Glenn back over here. Will you? Yeah. He'd flown home in the meantime. So we had to fly Glenn back over and we did a showcase. And it's really, when I think of it now, I mean, it was an absolute shitbox of a shed. That was where I was living, and just like perforated, like nearly egg cartons on the walls and a kind of, you know, mad studio thing. I had my keyboard, and the only thing I had to put the keyboard on was a broken speaker. So I just balanced the keyboard on the top of the broken speaker and then started singing. And, you know, we sang, we did a cover of a song called That's My Home, We Cry, and Before the Worst. And by the time we left, they just were like, that's it. We want to sign you boys. And we were like, oh, what's the name of the band? And Mark, we kind of like looking around for a name. And it's always like, what's the story or what's the script? In Dublin, it's just Dublin lingo. And it just means like, well, what's, you know, tell us a story really. And it just ended up sticking. It was kind of the one that we least laughed at the most, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
Like, wasn't it? It's a script. The script. That's actually all right. Like,
yeah, we'll go with that one.
Yeah, yeah. The rest of them were terrible, you know.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's how we started. And then,
when does it blow up then?
I think, really took our force, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Like, introduction.
Well, the mad part, we'd moved over to America and tried to make it over in America, and then we got signed in America and Mark's mom fell ill, and then he was just like, I have to go home, I've got to go look after me ma. So we literally moved, we just got signed and got the record deal, and then we moved everything to James Street. Mm. We had him out in Mark's mom's back garden out in Kent's Fort down in Mount Brown. So we moved the whole operation to Mount Brown, which was the best thing we ever did, because it just got me back in my roots again, got Mark back. You know, he's near his ma. His ma was in James Street at the time, and then he was just going in to visit his ma, could come out, and then he could pour all of that out into his music. And we recorded that first album just in the shadows of Guinness's brewery with the stank down there, you know, hops and barley. But yeah, I loved that time, because meanwhile Mark was kind of hanging with his family and his ma and getting a chance to spend time with her before she passed. I didn't even realise I was hanging out with my dad, and I hadn't seen him in years, you know, or hung out with him as an adult, let's say. And then shortly before we released our first album, he passed away as well. So it was like mad, just like tragedy after tragedy. And we didn't really know if we were going to come out as a band, because two shocking things happened. Mark's mom and my dad, literally in the space of about 6-7 months. His mom had kind of been prolonged, and my dad was literally overnight. You know, he was there in the morning, was talking to him, bang, he's gone by nighttime. Aneurysm and stuff was mental. But it was around that time. And then we started to do shows around. So we were like, well, we need to start doing this. So we started doing shows in the Sugar Club.
Yeah.
My brother does the sound in the Sugar Club, Ian. And we were like, well, look, we need somewhere to practice. We need something to do. So we went, we were like, we'll do first on the Battle of the Bands. You know what I mean? There's like six bands on. All those bands then sell tickets to their fans. You know, if they have 20 fans each, whatever, there's 200 people in there. And my maths is probably totally off right now. But there was people there anyway, you know what I mean? Told you I was shy at maths. Dyslexic. Don't be slagging me. But we started doing that. And then we started moving up the bill. So we were first on, and then the next few weeks, then we were second, middle. And then we started to headline it. And then about 7 weeks later then, and Sony UK were like, that's it. We're like, we want to really break these now. And they started to take the songs to radio, and Joe Wiley in the UK. It's very odd that an Irish act blows up in England and Ireland at the same time. Mm. And that was kind of because of those gigs. We'd been flying people over just to have a look, and the label had been flying people over, and they just felt, nah, there's something different here. There's something really kicking off here. And We Cry was the first song to debut over there on Joe Wiley. And then that went, I think it went in straight in like number 12 or something. And then bang, boys are on the map. Yeah. Foot is in the door.
Yeah.
Fucking.
And then if you thought you were doing well there, the man who can't be moved then was just next level.
That was, that was the last song to come on that album, actually. The album was done and we didn't have Break Even or Man Who Can't Be Moved. And Mark was like, I just feel like there's something missing on the album. I was like, what do you mean? He's like, we're after signing off on the album. He says, no, go back in the studio again. We'll go in and just see if we can see what happens. And I came up with that guitar riff for The Man Who Can't Be Moved. And he was laying the track down on it. And two of our mates came in and we just kind of thrown this idea around of this guy who goes back to the corner where he first met. It was kind of loosely based on Forrest Gump.
So it wasn't based on a love interest from one of you in the band?
Well, it's to be honest, I was writing it about the girl I was with at the time.
Right.
And the mad part is, if you're working together on a song, you can't be singing about his missus.
Yeah.
You can't be singing. So you kind of pour a bit. Well, you can be, but...
Depends on what you're into.
Yeah. It does. You're into loads of stuff. But you kind of pour your own angle into it.
Yeah.
So I was... I had broke up with a girl in America because she was like, you're nothing but a dreamer, it's not going to happen and stuff. And then I broke up.
She's sick.
No, I was sick. Dude, I broke up with her and then I was like, oh no, like I'm not going to see her again and this, that and the other. And then Mark's mom falls ill and I'm after breaking. It was a horrible breakup. And then now, bang, I'm back in Dublin and she's here and she's with her new fella and I want to get her back. And I'm here and things are kicking off for me now. And it's, I told you, and it's, she's moved on now and it was... really heartbreaking for me for a number of years, you know. The only saving grace is kind of like, yeah, kind of thing like, how you like me now?
Yeah.
A little bit, but
the
yeah.
It's the video shot in LA, is it?
The video for Man Who, yeah. Shot in LA.
Yeah.
You made it snow over there as well, yeah.
Yeah.
Snowing on the corner.
But, because I remember that was huge, and then I remember like playing FIFA, and
yeah.
The Emroy Begin was on it.
Yeah.
These fucking lads are bleeding huge. Once you were on FIFA back
that's
then,
it,
you made it.
That's
you
it.
Made it, but now, like, Terrence could be on FIFA next year. Yeah. You know what I mean? They really lowered the bar.
But, like,
back then, if you were on FIFA, like,
oh, that's it.
That's
what
everyone knew. Like, Two Door Cinema Club sold out Fairview Park there the weekend, solely based off FIFA change. Yeah. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But back then, and then, like, I remember, like, you was at Come Up. I was a big fan back in the day. Not saying I'm not now, but I was.
Oh, yeah.
Yes, headlined.
It was astronomical back then. It was like nobody had done it, something like that, since U2 or something like that. So,
yeah.
Like, you're like 90210, we were on that. We were on The Hills. Yeah, loads of American shows. What's his name? David Letterman. We were on that before he left. Jeez, everything. Literally everything. Yeah. Jimmy Fallon.
I remember he's open for, was it Take That in Croke Park?
Yeah.
It was Take That, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Remember he's open by them as well. And I was like, these boys are everywhere. But then, when was your first point gig down the Tree Arena?
Oh, God. The first gig. I think it was definitely, obviously, it was off that first album. We did 5 nights in a row. It was, that was the first time we played. We did a 5-night stand there.
Yeah.
And I don't know who was supporting us.
Wait, your first time playing there, you did five?
We did five in a row, yeah.
Yeah.
Doing all right, weren't you?
Yeah, it was nuts. Honestly.
Not like we'll do one at two and test the water. There's five of them there, please.
Yeah, five. Yeah, I'll have five there, yeah. Five to go.
Keep it going. Not around there, yeah.
And a Coke, thanks very much.
Yeah. Well, I went to see us down there and you finished on The Man Who Can't Be Moved and you were saying that you were like, when we wrote this song in a shed on Thomas Street, I never thought it'd make it here. And I was like, that's class. And you had a jacket on, you opened the jacket and you had the tricolour on.
Yeah, that's
like,
right.
And the whole place erupted.
Yeah.
This is fucking class.
Yeah.
And then that was it. I was like, these boys, lethal, you know what I mean?
Yeah. That was John Favartos. You know that John Favartos?
No, that's a bit out of my pay grade.
All Saints. You know All Saints?
Yeah.
So All Saints, the guy who designs all the stuff for All Saints, he was a fan of the band. And he was like, listen, we want to make you something special. So we did the tricolour in the inside of the jacket. Gosh. And so I had my white t-shirt on and then it'd be, you know, the green, white and orange.
Yeah.
Fucking deadly. I love that. Yeah. Still have it at home. I've got all those jackets. Stupidly thinking that there's going to be a museum one day and it's all going to be put on statues or something.
Just holding them.
You have to have that, you know, the mindset though, you know.
Yeah, just in case. I couldn't tell you who opened for me because we bunked into that one.
Oh, did you?
Obviously, after the support act, come on, you know what I mean? So I'll probably owe you a few quid, Danny, yeah?
No worries, I'll get it off you after.
Revolution.
Did you? Did you just bunk in, did you?
Yeah.
Deadly.
Never paying into the concert, are you mad?
Deadly.
Yeah. But me and my mate bunked in, that was it. Because I remember you saying that, and you were talking about all the pubs that you played along the quays and all. You're like, we played in this pub and that pub. And
yeah.
Now we're here, and I was like, this is fucking deadly, like, you know what I mean? Great to see.
Well, it was about, I met Mark when I was about 13, 14. Up in Ballantyre, and he was teaching dancing up there. He was teaching break dancing, and I just thought it was the best shit ever, seeing someone fucking body popping and locking and all. And he had a racket going on where if you were good enough a dancer, he'd then have you out teaching for him. And then on the weekends, then we'd all be dancing in the raves. So we'd be doing like Sides, I don't remember it's Sides or the Olympic or any of those places that we go years and years ago. So we'd have like the whole white gloves brigade with the whistles and the half masks and all this kind of stuff. We'd be walking out doing robot and all that. It was just great education as a kid because you're just up performing and, you know, getting a bit of money and having a, you know, a few drinks and whatever. It was great crack back then.
You've had a rough couple of years now.
Yeah.
Recently.
Yeah.
Well, obviously you lost, Mark. You mentioned at the start. Yeah. What's that been like for you?
Earth shattering, you know, devastating. I'm still trying to figure out and go through the grief stages. I don't even know where I am in it. I don't know if I've even acknowledged that it's happened yet, because it's such a weird thing to have known someone my whole life, because I know I'm nearly 30 years, over 30 years, and to have been on such a monumental life journey together that I'm the only person, besides obviously Glenn, but Glenn, I know him nearly 12 years more than I know Glenn, but to be on that kind of a curve through life with somebody and then for them to just gone, it's mad. It's a mad thing to try and deal with. So I think for me, I've always been one that tends to go like straight in, black hole, see you later, like peace out, see you all next year with everything. So I'm all in. If I'm doing bad stuff, I'm all in on the bad stuff. So I'm, you know, I'd say most of last year I was trying to tell people to hold on to my ankles, because I'm probably going to go down a big deep hole here. So I try to look in the past and go, right, when anything devastating's gone on in my life, what have I done? And I've gone off the rails every time. And then I've tried to hope that music's going to pull me back in again, or my love for music or something else is going to pull it in. And 9 times out of 10, looking back, Mark was normally the person who pulled me back. Mm-hmm. And to not have him around, I was terrified, to be honest, of what I was become, getting bitter or whatever. You never know where you'd end up these days. And then, so when it happened, I don't know why I did, maybe 2 weeks after he passed away, and I got a friend to give me a number of a therapist. And I called him up and I said, I think this might be the calm before the storm, because I feel like I'm all right, but I know me and I just want someone to keep an eye on me, because I don't have that arm and the shoulder anymore to just pull me back if I'm a bit, you know, wayward and stuff. And then, so I started talking to a therapist and didn't quite know why I was doing it originally, because I'm like, I'm all right, nothing's going on and this, that and the other. But over the weeks and then over the months, and how grief changes and turns on you, and you think you're all right, but you're not. And then all of these different things, and to be able to be walked through that with someone who is a professional, because you can ask your mate for help, but also a lot of times they're not professional. So a lot of times your mate would go, ah, fucking, we'll get down a few, have a few gargles and try and sort it out. And that's the worst thing. Because I go, 1, 2, fucking see you later, I'm gone.
Yeah.
So I think that was a massive one for me to try and reason with it and try and go, what the fuck, what are you taking him for? Like, look, he's, you know what I'm saying? When I say salt of the earth, he's like born and raised in James Street. He's never cheated on his missus. He's like, he is the stand-up guy that I base my life on, and go, he's stoic. Do you know what I mean? If I want to be any, I idolized him, you know, growing up. So to not have him around, I'm like, my guardrails are off. So having a therapist there was great. I've got a beautiful, beautiful missus who's been there through, like I said, through COVID, because it went COVID and then Mark passed away. So it's just like these fucking mad 3 years that I don't know what's going on. Like, I'm living this dream life and then just nightmare life. And then I'm trying to just come out from it a little bit. But like I said, I went off the rails, you know.
Was that your first time ever talking to a therapist?
Years ago when I was a kid, I talked to a therapist, yeah, over just certain different things growing up in a musical household. About my parents were, they weren't alcoholics, but they, you know, they drank a lot.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? And I don't think, like back then, I think even back to the dyslexic thing, if you had told my mom and dad that I had dyslexic when I was a kid, you'd probably say, like, thought the kid had AIDS or something. Because it was like a death sentence or something. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? It's like, they wouldn't have accepted it even if you tried to tell them.
Yeah.
And it was just different times, and it's hard looking back and to be mad, or because that was the time, you know, oh, you can't see the road. Come here, standing between you, me and your mammy, you'll see the road, you know, kind of vibe. And I felt like the stuff that went on in the gaff was just detrimental to me as a kid. And I didn't know, because I'd been in therapy as a kid and stuff. And I guess maybe something in me knew that this is a time you need to do something. Like, Glenn is a great source of all that kind of stuff, because he's, I think, 12 or 13 years sober now.
I'm going there.
Some going, yeah, and he lived primarily here as well. And so Ireland is like one of the worst places.
Yeah, it's a drinking culture, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, what else do you eat or not do that anybody else thinks there's something wrong with you? Like, if I said, no, I don't want mayonnaise in my sandwich, you don't want mayonnaise? Mm. Why are you addicted to mayonnaise? Like, is something wrong with you, you know? It's fucking mad, you know?
Yeah.
But it's incredibly hard here because we're so social and the weather's not great and most of our social lives are set around pubs.
Yeah.
So, yeah, so I went off the rails this year. I couldn't write, I couldn't verbalise, because my sparring partner wasn't there anymore. So I didn't have anything to throw off and just like throwing a ball and it's not coming back. And there was one lyric I was trying to articulate. It's like, he's gone too, you took him too fucking soon, you know what I mean? Take anybody else but him. It's a lovely family, you know, beautiful kids and beautiful family. And I came up with this lyric, which was like a shooting star across the sky in a second you were gone. Why do stars that light up twice as bright only burn for half as long? Mm-hmm. And it was just like, why did he always take the good ones early? And I just thought, like, after saying now how he means to me, and I feel like that's the first time the lyric came around where I was like, I nailed it. And at that point, Thorn kind of came out of my side, and I just was like verbal diarrhea. I was like, couldn't stop it from writing down. So I was like, all of it. So I needed something to maybe get me over that. I think therapy was a massive one. Being able to articulate how I feel to somebody else who doesn't have a horse in the race. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I'm saying? Because what am I going to do now? This, that, and the other. And depending on who you talk to, some people have invested interest in whether we continue on as the band or we don't, yeah, or how I feel, or do you know what I mean? So people would push it in. And to have somebody who's not my girlfriend who thinks, because I'm, like I said, I'm a man's man at the end of the day, and I don't want me missus thinking I'm second guessing myself or I'm up and down, left and right, or whatever. But I realise that I need somebody there that I can just verbalise all this stuff and then just go and wipe my feet as I'm coming back in the door, and then I can come back in. I can actually be a boyfriend to mm-hmm. me missus, and hurt for her not to have to listen to all of the stuff that I've been going on about, you know? So that was a huge one. And then, yeah, so I started writing again. And then I came back for Christmas. And this was just a story I don't mind telling you guys, but I came back for Christmas and I had it in my mind. And I says, right, I'm going to have a clean Christmas. I'm not going to drink, because it's a big thing to come home. It's the first time I've been home for a long time, because I know I'm just going to get asked about Mark every day, or, you know, isn't it sad he's gone and this, that, and the other. And I said, I'm not going to drink. And then I got on the airplane, and by the time I'd landed, I was pissed. And I was just, whiskeys and this, that, and the other on the plane. And I landed straight to the pub, Guinness's, and it was a bit of a blur, Christmas was for me. And I didn't realise how triggering it was for me. Dublin in general is triggering, because I grew up, I mean,
all the best memories I have.
Every part of it, and he's there in every corner he's standing on. Even here, Diggs Lane, I taught with him here in this building, you know. So I don't normally do a thing on Christmas Day where I go into Temple Street with the kids in there. And I've done it now 14 years in a row, where we go in 9 o'clock in the morning, go in, have an amazing time with the nurses in the morning, go around, visit the wards with John and there, the party, he's an amazing guy. And then so Christmas Eve, I was just like, right, cool, I'm not drinking. I got through that. And then as soon as I got to my brother's gaff, got pissed again. And then just started drinking and drinking. And I just ruined Christmas for myself.
Yeah.
And I ruined the memory of being here. So I says, December 27th, I got back to the UK and I was like, enough's enough. That's it. I'm finished. I'm finished with that fucking 44-year-old fella who's like, are we at a party again, is it? Oh, you have to have one sip. Oh, what's going on? What else is going on? It's like, I can't be doing this anymore, man. Mm. Like, if you're going to face grief and you're going to face something that's that important to you, you have to do it sober.
Mm. Such a mature decision to make. I know you said you're 44, but your fellow has literally the world at his feet. You probably have, there's no end to the amount of network and reach out and resources that you actually have. But for you to come in and say, listen, this is not the way to go with this. It's a dangerous cocktail to mix up here.
Yeah.
I don't want to keep dwelling on it.
No, go away.
What's it like being on stage realm?
It's really strange. It's really strange because a lot of the venues I've played before, so I have, like, it's almost like going to battle with somebody. I have him burnt on my right side. That's where he was, wingman. If I messed up a lyric or whatever, I look over and he's giving it back to me or whatever. We tried to change the formation on stage because it was the three piece. And then now we've kind of, we have a new guitarist, Ben. His name's Ben Weaver, but his middle name's Mark. what are the chances of that? Ben Mark Weaver. And the other bassist is called Ben, so we have two Bens now. But it's really strange. So there's a certain amount of, we're not trying to wipe over any memories. I'm just trying to create new ones and then try and create, and then just kind of deal with things as they come up. So like there's certain songs that are mental to sing now without him. You know, because I'm now doing all of his parts.
Mm.
So even in We Cry now, I'm doing the rap. And even in a song we have called If You Could See Me Now.
Yeah.
Which is
it's very personal to you, that song as well.
Ah, it's killer. It's killer. I mean, his verse in that, in second verse, is probably one of the best verses I've ever heard. And he wrote that because his dad had passed away when he was a young lad. He was 13 when his dad passed away. And then he had to kind of set him off on a trajectory, whatever. So he'd never talked about that ever publicly or even privately. But then he wrote that verse, you know, and it's just such an honor to sing his lyrics about him and his dad. But now I'm singing it about him.
Mm.
So it's layers of pain on top of pain on top of pain. But I've always, I just find that that's the best way I can get it out. So I've sang at everything I've ever done. You know, I sang at church as a kid, sang at me communion. My mom passed away. She wanted me to sing a song, I'm Yours, that was on the first album. So I sang it at her funeral. My dad, we sang Piano Man. All my whole family got up and sang at my dad's funeral. And then we sang, myself and Glenn got up and sang at Mark's funeral. So music is, it's tied into us. And it's like, how dare you not perform, you know what I mean? Or even continue on this journey that we've been on. But yeah, no, I appreciate the question as well, because it's kind of what I'm thinking myself. How is it? And it changes from sometimes it's good, and then other times I'm waiting for the cue for him to do something and he's not there.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Or it doesn't come or whatever. Or so, you know what I mean?
It's
same thing with anyone who's lost anybody. You kind of tend to, you know, like in those moments where you get something really fucking good's happening. That's me boys. Yeah. Call him up.
And yeah.
He's weird, you know. Obviously, there's a very public front with the script, and where, you know, we have to be jovial and la 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 all the time. He'd go to war for you, this fella, do you know what I mean? But we'd always like be thinking about what we're going to be doing, what we're going to say. And so I always feel like, yeah, I just feel like I'm down a man, do you know what I mean, at this point.
Mm. What you waiting for? Put your back in it. Just a little more. Throw your weight in it now. Tell your body okay. This podcast is supported by FlyFit. With 20 locations nationwide, there's always a FlyFit gym nearby to help you crush your fitness goals. Start from just €35 per month, you'll get access to state-of-the-art equipment, unlimited classes and facilities that make every workout first class.
Smash your fitness goals guided by expert trainers and surrounded by a supportive community. That's a FlyFit promise.
Join the FlyFit family today and start your journey to a fitter, healthier you.
Visit flyfit.ie to find your nearest location and sign up now.
You done the voice.
Yeah.
And I heard the story that you got a bit of stick off James Corden over it.
Well, that was a kind of crazy time, because I was at the, I just found out that I got the voice, as in like, it was a TV opportunity for us to go and just spread the name of the band again, because we're always like, you know, if there's an opportunity, get me in there. And I think it was at the Brits, and James Corden was hosting the Brits. And I was at the table, it was like my first time there, and I'm looking around and all like, it's your iTunes homepage is there, you know, all the artists that you love and know, it's Christina Aguilera and whoever else is there, and everyone's Jessie J and all this, that and the other. And it was, because I was the least known member of the voice crew, James Corden turns around and he was like, someone was like, Danny O'Donnell, what? Donna who? I don't know, whatever. And I was just like, I just got dissed. And he was like, I don't care who the other guy was. I can't remember what he said. And I just sat there and I just went, because it's like, he doesn't, how dare you, he says, if he comes near me now, I'm going to grab this bun and I'm going to bun fight him right in the top of the head and noggin. When he's standing, do you mind, he's standing there, next up, bang. You know, a little bread roll comes flying out of nowhere. And I was raging. My ma was watching that and all, and he goes and slags me on it. You can see I'm getting all defensive. Yeah. My arms are going, see me body changing shape and all. Yeah, and then somebody asked me about it afterwards, and they were like, what are you going to say into when you bump into James Corden? I says, I won't bump into him, I'll bump off him.
Yeah.
And he's like, what, you calling him fat or whatever? And I was like, no, bump off, like, loaf him when I see him, don't worry. And it just got all out of hand, and he heard that I was, I don't know, threatening him or something. Yeah. So it's kind of like me, like,
yeah, blown up about proportionally.
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah. What was that like doing that anyways? That looked like good crack.
The voice?
Yeah.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
Ah, great crack. Yeah, like I said, my dad played behind Tom Jones years and years ago. So when I got to meet Tom, most people didn't know what to say to him. I'm just like, you know, me dad Shea, and you know, a few stories from back in the day. So he was more like having your outfielder there beside you. And then we had such great crack. Jesse was, you know, an amazing singer. Will was just the best, because I've grown up a Black Eyed Peas fan.
Mm.
And just absolutely loved him and all the stuff that he did back in the day with Fergie with Justin Timberlake even. Where's the Love he wrote with Justin Timberlake, which we were around back in Orlando. So I had all those things to kind of chat about, and I just loved doing the show because it was something I know about. And if I'm on a car show or whatever, I don't know nothing about cars, but it was something I know about. And then also the premise of the show was that it was like you give people bad news in a good way, because you had like Cole and Louis Walsh and all being like, yeah, fucking shite, it is, you know, and just to have that happen to you on television. I mean, it's already nerve-wracking enough going on TV, but then somebody like making a fool out of you, not good at all. So we kind of, you know, I suppose I got a bit of stick for not being hard enough on people, but
that's not
who I am. So I'd rather be condemned for who I am really than trying to be someone I'm not. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because you try and do that, then everyone else is like, he's not that way. Yeah. Like, do you know what I mean? You get found out anyway. Anyway, so yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you have a new album coming out, Danny.
Yeah.
Tell us about it. I like the what's the cover of it?
Yeah.
The cover of it is unbelievable.
Yeah. Thank you.
It's unbelievable. Who came up with that idea? Was that yourself?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, no. I've got a guy, Gary, who he's done all of our albums, and I just said to him, I said, look, we've a bit of a weird scenario going on. Obviously, we want to pay respects to Mark, give it a bit of a different feel and a different vibe, and kind of some of the, I kind of got all of the albums together that we'd done before, and I was like, it has to be something new and different. And we went with the black and white. Funny enough, my girlfriend took that photograph, the one that's on the front of it. So that photograph of us all with my hands out and all, that's taken from my apartment down to the car park and the bus station. And then we took it all in, and then a mate of mine, Gary, did all the artwork on it. But there's a silhouette just on the far left. So myself and Glenn are in it, and Ben, who's always been on stage. And then there's a silhouette, which we have as, it's basically Mark, you know, he's like, he's still there with us, because we're never going to repeat what the script was, the three piece. So it was iconic, it was what it was, and I feel like you're never going to fill his boots, so why even try? Do you know what I mean? It's like you're almost trying to pave over it like it never happened or something, and it'll always be part of our history. And I feel like in order for us to move on, and also to bring people along on this next part of the journey, let's just change the lineup. Let's give it four. Let's change the whole lineup and everything else about us. So the album cover is a bit different. The fact that there's four of us now in the band is a bit different as well. So it takes even more onus off if somebody was coming in that they're trying to be Mark, or they're trying to fill his shoes or something. Do you know what I mean? It's just, that's unfair, because he'll never will. So, but yeah, like, it's, we're dealing with this in real time. This is not, you know, do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And I don't mind being open about it. It's like, we'll ask fans as well. We'd be like, what do you guys think? You know, obviously everyone, we went on, after Mark passed away, we went on what felt like an open funeral, as in Mark's, we had a private funeral. We had one in the UK for him, and we had another one here. The president came to it as well, which is brilliant. But it was really private. But none of our fans and none of his fans and stuff around the world got to mourn him. So we went around, we did two gigs, we did two shows in the UK specifically for that reason, for all the UK fans to come and kind of mourn and stuff. And then we were out on tour with Pink, doing her stadium tour. And then we took a moment in that set to acknowledge him. I did an acoustic version of You Can See Me Now.
Mm-hmm.
And then just kind of got that out. And then that's our way of letting everybody grieve through it. So we kind of, we're kind of dealing with it in real time as well, like I said. And we're just, we ask people for feedback all the time. How are we doing?
Yeah.
Is it the right thing to do? And we'll know when it feels wrong, but it still feels, it feels right, because I have him in my ear just being like, finish what we start.
Yeah.
Finish it.
And you play, you do a nod to him in a lot of the songs as well, but I think Gone is the one that's specifically for him.
Yeah.
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 We've listened to the album. It's very good.
Oh, thanks, dude. We were allowed to say that or not?
No, you can say it. You can say it.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah, you can say it. Yeah.
Just don't share the album on your story, Terrence.
Yeah, yeah, that's it. Yeah, that's it. Oh, that's fair, in fairness, whatever. It's gonna, like, leak it. Oh,
yeah. Oh, no.
Do you know what I mean? Like, people are leaking their albums all over the place. You know? Yeah, like, oh, it wasn't meant to happen. Wasn't meant to happen.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Set up a ghost account. Yeah. Retweet or whatever.
Because I only text Calvin earlier, and I was like, this is mad, isn't it? This is homework, like, for our job. You get to listen to the fucking script.
Yeah.
Unreleased album.
Yeah,
I get sent in. It's like, don't share this with anybody. And I'm like, I don't know if I can deal with
straight
that.
Straight up on SoundCloud. Yeah, it's already available right now. Yeah.
But it's out on the 16th of August.
Yeah, yeah.
It's called Satellites.
Yeah.
And there's a new single that's out now.
Yeah, Boat Ways.
Boat Ways. Yeah.
Not Boat Race.
How would you feel about the album, all in all?
Personally, we never come out without being satisfied about the album.
Yeah.
I'm 100% nervous about it, because I feel like the eyes are going to be on it, because no one ever really knows who did what.
Yeah.
So there's going to be, if I know there's always, because when you get, you guys probably realize this, when you get to a certain size, you split opinion. And the more people like you, there's definitely a subsection that go, just because they like you, I'm just going to fucking be the juxtaposition. Yeah. I'm going to be the thumb. Do you know what I mean? And go, whatever. So I know, I'm already expecting there to be a certain, it's not the same as it was before. That's going to happen. And then I'm also quite nervous in, like I said, yeah, just how it's going to be received. You know, you can't help but think about, like, social media is so fucked that, you know, people would just be lambasting you just for the sake of it.
Yeah.
They'd be trolling you in anyway. So I'm happy that I've gotten all of the things that I needed to say out in this year. And that's kind of the way we plan it, is we record for a year, we tour for a year, record for a year. Well, we have done most of our career. So I feel like I've gotten everything off my plate that I needed to. And that's normally when I kind of go, right, I'm done here, rinsed it a little bit. But I feel like, yeah, I feel like I was really honest in it. Some of the songs, Home Is Where the Hurt Is, talking about growing up in Dublin and all those things, is like, it's the things that break us, that make us who we are. And we are who we are. We are who we are. I can hear these songs. They're like, I've managed to take a bit of pain and then origami some whittle some fucking something beautiful out of it. Mm-hmm. And it's like, you know, it's mine, it's pain, but it's my pain, and send it out into the world. So I kind of feel, I'm excited about all that. And I'm excited about people to see the new, I'm going to say the new script, just like this new kind of formation that we are, you know, the new version.
New direction.
Yeah.
New direction.
Yeah, the new direction.
Let's put it that way.
Yeah, direction. New direction.
Yeah. Wrong direction. just to let you know, so I looked up today, is that playing in November on The Point?
Yeah.
Three dates.
Yeah.
Three sold out.
That's right.
And he's still talking about leading blagging his way around.
Pasta syndrome.
Yeah. Yeah. But a little boardy told us as well. So you actually did say yourself that you're supporting Pink, but you just have to go back to Scotland now to support Pink.
Oh, yeah, yeah. We flew in. We said we were on in Anfield last night. And then we did two nights there. And then we just flew in today to do press, do your show. And then we play Hampden Park then tomorrow. Fly there. And we play Hampden Park Friday and Saturday, two nights. And then we fly to Burn. I mean, literally, it's Burn, baby, non-stop. Burn the whole time. Yeah. You know? So we it's non-stop. Then the album's out in August. Then we've got all our promo in between that. And then we go to the States. Because Boatways is it debuted at number 40 in the charts over there now. So it just went bang straight in. Mm. So now we've got all that to go chase. It's funny when you're releasing everywhere. You're like, oh, okay, it's working there. Let's go. You know what I mean? It's, whoa, let's go. Trying to put the fires out and stuff. But it's been really fun, though, because I've been getting to do stuff I love doing. So on Monday gone, I got to go down and train with Tom Aspinall.
Yeah.
You know, like the UFC interim champ.
We're going to the Manchester show.
Are you? Yeah.
Hello, yeah.
All right, brilliant. So I went, I did his fight lab, you know, Tom Aspinall's fight lab. Because I train all the time.
Yeah, so that's what I wanted to even ask you as well. You do train, don't you, combat sports?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I've been training hard.
Just let you know, like, you know what I mean?
Oh, look,
yeah, I can train.
Yeah, yeah, no, I train.
Get James Corden now.
He wouldn't stand a chance. You can tell it's a sore spot with me as well, can't you? You see, as soon as his shoulder started to go, I'm looking uncomfortable now, I am. No, I'd never forget anything like that. There's three people. I'm not going to name the other two. I won't let it slip.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But you do train combat. What do? You do Muay Thai, do you?
Yeah, yeah. I started off boxing, and then my mate of mine was like, give me your hardest punch. So my hook was me hardest punch. And then he says, hold the pads, and he kicked the pads, and he nearly broke me wrists. And I was like, teach me the ways, I'll master.
Yeah.
And I got heavy, heavy into my Muay Thai for a long time. So I did that for about 4 years. And then kind of, not love, hate, it was like me knees love and hate me. So I got a bit of ligament damage on my knee. So when they give me jip, I just got back into striking and then just do boxing.
Yeah.
So I've been, I'd say heavy training for about 3 years now, but on and off, when I say heavy, every day. But I would do three times a week and then we spar on Sundays. But I'll do it because the last tour, what I'll do is, because I love the UFC, but I'll try and find out, because people, if you're a fighter, they won't let you in any of these camps.
Yeah.
So what I do is I call up as the pop star. Oh, hey, I'm in town and any chance I can come down and maybe hit a few pads or something. And I've gotten in everywhere. I was training with Darren Till and Cow Bond Gym. That's where I met Tom first. Yeah. And then I went up to the Scottish Hit Squad with Paul Craig up there.
Yeah.
Trained with him. Got on to own Roddy. Trained with him whenever I'm home, and then they know everybody in every other city.
Yeah.
So I'd be going training. I'd be training here maybe with own Roddy the mornings of the gigs.
Yeah.
So I'd do an hour out there on the mats with him, and then come in and then do the show. But this is kind of what I was going to say. It links into mental health.
Mm.
And when I came back in December, I went heavy into training again, and that to me is my medicine.
Yeah.
So I came home, started going, right, I'm doing every day. I'll do Monday to Friday. Sometimes I'll take a Wednesday off because you can't hard train, and then take a day off on Saturday and then spar on a Sunday. Just light body sparring if I'm gigging. But then I'll do full sparring if I've got a broken leg gap, you know what I mean? Yeah. Like a 6 week window. Where
Oh,
dude, I broke me ribs. I left the jab out too long, and the guy swooped underneath. I cracked me there and broke me rib, and I couldn't sing for 6 weeks.
It's a cunt, and I broke him rib.
Bro.
Thank God I'm learning.
But all you can do is nothing. You can't do nothing. They give you a lollipop and then just tell you, you can't go on your side. You can't be with your missus and all. You can't be doing nothing. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Do you know, Kiefer Crosby broke Terence's ribs.
Yeah, training MMA as well, yeah.
How did he break your ribs? He kick you?
No, he's just slamming me off the mat. So we
Kiefer is brilliant.
Yeah, he's an animal, isn't
he? Do you know what? He's absolutely sound as well. Like, obviously in the ring, he's a total animal.
Yeah.
But I've never had a trainer like him who explains stuff as well as him.
So in detail, isn't he?
I think he'd do great on like a Fight Lab or doing commentary on something.
Yeah, 100%.
I really do, yeah.
Mm. I said this to you as well. I was only saying it to somebody the other day as well. The details that he goes into, he trained us for a session up in SBG.
Yeah.
And every fine detail.
Yeah.
I was like, this is madness. But it's the same with Owen Roddy. I did a session with Owen as well.
Yeah.
And the details with these people.
So you do loads of training yourself, do you?
Here and there. I'm not as consistent as you sound.
Okay, yeah, yeah.
Everybody.
Do you know what? I don't know if they still have it in there, but they contacted me. Owen was like, would you do a celebrity MMA thing? And I says, yeah. I see. It goes, I haven't told you the pony yet. I said, I don't care who it is. I'll just get straight in now. Honestly, I went there. I was like, for the whole week, I was like, that's it. I'm getting the fight going. And it never happened, but I'm 100% down for it.
Yeah.
If I had a bit of time, like I said, just give me a 6-week window where the bumps and bruises will heal up.
Yeah.
I can get my management to sign off on it.
You sound like the busiest man in the whole entire world, Danny. You're at the been telling us your whole script for the next couple of months and I'm bollocks listening to
it. Next summer. Next summer. It was kind of, well, we're on tour all the way till November, December. We do the UK run and then we're off to Asia. Then after that, we do the Australasia tour then. So it's all Australia, every, you know, all the way over there, Thailand, Philippines, Manila, Jakarta, all those places. So I'll be training out there as well. I'll get trainers out on, down like Tiger in Thailand.
Yeah, Bangtan and stuff like that.
Yeah.
All these places are supposed to be unbelievable.
Bangtan, now where's that? Where's he going in Thailand? Come on.
Back from Thailand as well.
Send me location.
Send location.
Things are going now, Danny, with the whole celebrity fucking crossover and the combat sport. You might actually get a shout off Jake Paul or something.
Oh, listen, I'd
on one
that.
Of his cards.
I don't know if I'd ever fight him because you just make a fool of you. You know what I mean?
Like, not him, but you'd fight someone on the undercard.
Oh yeah, dude. Who would you put me up against?
You're a big fella. Yeah, very big fella. So
six four.
Yeah, deceivingly big.
I'll tell you what Calvin said when you came in. You went to the toilet. He looked at me and he went, "The Eddie Hearn fella," and that's a reference to when Eddie Hearn came in as well. We were looking up, going, "The fucking size of
yeah, Eddie's fucking
big,
huge.
Dude. Big fella. Yeah.
He was a big fella now,
and someone who has to train. And it's got to be age appropriate as well. There's nobody who's 44 is in the same shape as me.
All right.
Love that.
I'm telling you. You obviously haven't seen me train, so.
Yeah, I do. I'd like to do a bit of training.
I'm confident, haven't I? He's confident. Yeah.
What about
blagging?
Not James Corden. One of the other two people who you have a vendetta over.
I don't think they'd ever fight me.
No.
Oh. Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
Leave it with us. We'll come back to it. Now, Danny, as we said, yeah, the busiest man in the world. Yeah. You're literally flying straight out of here. We really appreciate it. There was a time, not going to lie, we were sitting out there being like, he's not going to show up.
Really?
He's not going to show up, this fella. But
for you guys as well, fair play on the podcast. It's really
great. Thanks very much.
And it's one of the only interviews where it's to hear and actually open up because I know he's aren't going to stitch me up. It's all from the heart and he's a salt of the earth. Mm. So fair play to
thanks
you.
Thanks very much. And we appreciate you coming in and willingly open up as well. We didn't have to drag that out with you. Some people come in with their guard up. You're actually out there trying to portray this message to people like, look, this is what I'm going through, this is how I'm dealing with it. Even as simple as like I reached out to a friend, they got a therapist's phone number.
Yeah,
you didn't like get some ultra big fucking unreachable therapist.
Yeah, called Dr. Phil or something. Yeah.
No, but you literally reached out to a friend to get a therapist number. Yeah. That's people need to hear that, you know what I mean?
And you know what? And the lads as well, training is just
100%.
There's something about this world is like, you know, desensitizing young fellas to like you can't fight and you can't be aggressive and your violence has a place in this to get the violence out.
Yeah.
It has a place and
in
training.
A controlled environment.
Controlled environment. Yeah. It puts discipline on you, puts manners on you. I'm a big believer. As soon as I have kids, bang, they'll all be straight. I wish I'd only found it sooner.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
100%. Yeah. And it's great, yeah. Danny, anything else you want to mention or plug?
No, just long may he's continue.
Brilliant, mate. Appreciate that. All right, Terry, all done?
Yeah.
Take us out, Siobhan.
Boom.
Subscribe to this podcast for free on the Go Loud app. What you waiting for? Put your back in it. Just a little more. Throw your whip in it now. Till your body attends. Walk it hard and low. When you finish that. The Hypnoka.